Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
I think one of the limitations is always data.
Nate Kaufman heads up the Omaha branch of the Kansas City Federal Reserve.
If you're trying to develop thoughts and ultimately an argument that is supported by something that is data-based, then your main constraint is almost always the data or the information. Let's call it information that you're relying on to inform those views. You know, in a perfect world, we would know all things at all times as to how conditions are evolving, so you could tell a very consistent and perfect story about what's happening with respect to the economy. But the reality is that you don't have that. So you have to rely on either imperfect data or impartial data, or in some cases, data that you don't have, and try to make connections from one place to another to help fill in the gaps of what you might be missing that's needed for that narrative.
This is Agriculture Today.
For the first time in two decades, U.S. beef producers will be able to ship fresh and frozen product to Australia. National Cattlemen's Beef Association confirming Wednesday Australia has agreed to ease long-standing restrictions, marking the end of a 20-year trade imbalance. According to NCBA, Australia exported nearly $29 billion worth of beef to the U.S. over that period, while American beef locked out of Australia due to regulatory and animal health concerns. Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins said NCBA and President Trump secured the agreement, removing the final barriers. Australia's Ag Ministry said the decision followed a science and risk-based review. Beginning July 28th, Australian companies may apply for permits to import American beef. Country will now accept U.S. beef from animals born in the U.S., Canada, or Mexico, so long as they were legally imported and slaughtered in the country. Change comes after enhanced U.S. efforts to track animal movement and improve biosecurity, especially against diseases like avian influenza and New World screwworm. Still, analysts say exports to Australia are likely to remain modest due to higher U.S. cattle prices. In Australia, their cattle industry leaders raising concerns about biosecurity, calling for a full independent review before the agreement takes place. Record high beef prices at the retail level may soon begin to moderate, though. After hitting a peak in June, the wholesale market has started trending downward. Retail prices have climbed in recent months due to reduced slaughter rates and tight beef supplies just as grilling season peaked. That led to a sharp rise in both wholesale and consumer prices, and that's according to Dr. David Anderson, a livestock economist with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension. Now, the choice boxed beef cutout topped $394 per hundredweight about 4 weeks ago, but it's declined steadily since. Ribeyes dropping from $14.18 to $10.50 per pound. Loin strips fell from $11.84 to $9.68. But lean boneless beef remains high, with 50% lean product hitting a record $2.62 per pound. Seasonal trends suggest prices usually ease after the 4th of July, but while it's unlikely retail prices will fall below last year's level, current drop in wholesale prices indicates that relief could be coming, though with the usual lag between wholesale and retail movement. A recent study by the University of Illinois shows that larger farms in Illinois don't always have lower costs per acre. Data from Illinois Farm Business Farm Management averaged over 2021 through 2024 reveals regional and size-based differences in crop and equipment expenses. In northern Illinois, crop costs tend to decline on farms larger than 4,000 acres, especially for fertilizer and pesticides. Central Illinois farms see little change in total crop cost with size, though fertilizer and pesticide expenses do drop on bigger farms, and southern Illinois farms experience rising crop cost up to 4,000 acres, then a decrease for larger farms. Study emphasized that cost efficiencies depend on region and farm management, and farmers encouraged to analyze their own records to find strategies to improve cost control and long-term profitability. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Look, August, Republicans, we're going to go out and tell the morality of people's taxes not going up next year, what we did in the reconciliation budget of incentives to invest in America, to build new plants of equipment, for working people to have some things to actually draw them back into the labor force, no tax on tips, no tax on overtime.
Representative David Schweikert from Arizona is chairman of the Congressional Joint Economic Committee.
Understand, baseline, over the next 10 years, according to the Congressional Budget Office, we're going to spend $86 trillion. Think of the screaming and mashing of teeth and protests, so they're all ginned up. You cut, what is it, $800 billion from this and a little bit from some couple other things. It was less than 2% of that spending. Are you telling me that the left doesn't believe that if you're spending $86 trillion is your baseline spending? And understand, I'm going to show you some of the charts, how much of this is basically demographics. We got old. Our healthcare costs. I'm going to show you a couple charts here in a couple of moments that I really want folks to understand. But for the American people, when you see someone from the Democratic Party behind a microphone going, they cut spending, it's this off of a base of this. It's the lack of understanding. And look, one of the points that you keep trying to make over and over and over and over and over again is, was the Democrats' plan that they wanted to raise taxes on everyone? Because that was automatic. That was coming at the end of this year. Your taxes were going up back to the pre-2017 tax reform. Every once in a while you get, well, you shouldn't have extended the tax policy for the highest income. But that's a tiny, tiny portion of the total dollar amounts. And look, when they had control of everything, they didn't do it. But just from a point, and this is more for everyone to understand, particularly even staff. You see the blue here? Non-defense, defense, every dime of that is borrowed. And I think this year we'll probably borrow, let's call it $400 billion of Medicare. So my best estimate, and we're going to actually hold a contest shortly to see who can guess the final borrowing for this year. And the economy's actually been pretty good. We're tracking, we think actually, customs receipts. If any of you think of it as tariffs, we may have another $70 billion on top of baseline. It's probably going to come at $2.2 trillion of borrowing this year. So this doesn't have the tax reform, many of those things much built into that base. But understand, in this country, how do I help folks understand? Here's where we're already at. And this will make sense in a little while. For every dollar we take in tax receipts, we spend $1.39. We spend $1.39 for every dollar we take in tax receipts. But if you saw that previous chart, you've noticed that only about 24 to 26% is in discretionary, what we really get to vote on. That's why you end up having to use what we call these reconciliation budgets. 1974 Budget Control Act allows us to move a bill if it has certain fiscal properties to it through the Senate without having to get 60 votes. It's all a dance to deal with the 60 votes. If we were actually a little more honest about math, maybe we wouldn't have to do this dance.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, Congress has prohibited states from imposing additional or different labeling and packaging requirements beyond the federal standards.
At a recent House Ag Committee hearing on crop protection, Chairman from Pennsylvania, G.T. Thompson.
Unfortunately, there has been misinterpretations related to this policy, which could eventually lead to an unworkable patchwork of state regulations or growers losing access to products altogether because of litigation. As a grower in California who relies on these products, what impact would it have on your operation if you were to lose access to products if Congress does not act to clarify that statute?
Mr. Chairman, California many times is at a disadvantage because we have dual registration. Products may be available across the state line that aren't available within our state. So if you have growers growing the same crop in two different states, If you're in California, you don't have the same tools to be able to move forward and protect your crop. And many times it may be a safer material, a less expensive material. We know costs of growing in California are extremely expensive and highly regulated. So it tends to, the patchwork that we see going on tends to put our growers at a very strong disadvantage. We would love to see uniformity throughout the United States on labeling requirements.
Well, thank you, sir. Mr. Abbott, much of your testimony was focused on the need for a well-functioning EPA Office of Pesticide Programs. It seems that over the past few years, the EPA has been slow to register new chemistries, which are of critical importance to growers who need every tool that they can get to control damaging pests, weeds, and diseases. What actions should Congress consider to support a more efficient, science-based EPA regulatory process that fosters innovation and ensures growers have access to safe, effective crop protection tools?
Well, if I might, going back in the history of my career, I saw resistance firsthand. So I think it's important that we fund the Office of Pesticide. You've heard me say that already, and I think it's crucial that we continue to make sure those dollars funnel down to adequate staffing so we can push through those regulatory hurdles. Because ultimately, the grower pays for it, right? You got the ag value chain. Yes, we're all involved in that, from the manufacturers all the way to distributors, but the growers are the ones that are suffering. And ultimately, that translates down to us as the consumer. If they can't grow the food, we can't buy the food.
One of the key drivers of innovation in agriculture, particularly as we look at the inputs that producers rely on, is having a regulatory system that is predictable, science-based, and timely. To any of the panelists, can you discuss how having a well-functioning regulatory framework enables companies to invest in research and bring new products to the market more efficiently? And what are the potential consequences for farmers and broader ag industry if regulatory delays, inconsistent policy, or politicized decision-making begin to erode the certainty that innovators rely on to develop these tools?
I think having it being predictable, meaning that we understand the time frames, that really lets you allow for what money is going to be needed in order to get a new concept through the regulatory process and then out into commercial ability. Part of that would be very predictive in terms of, you know, you've provided all the science and all of the requirements to the different agencies that they can go through and check that, and that you know that that's going to happen in a timely six-month period or something to that effect. Right now, it is often paused and left to different timelines, and so now you're left trying to figure out, do I need to have enough money to keep the company alive and the focus alive for 18 to 24 months instead of just six? So I think having that predictability is important for helping us understand what it's going to take to get innovation across the line and out to the growers.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So my primary role would be to ensure that the areas where I have some expertise would be included in those discussions, and ultimately views being represented from either that industry or that segment region of the economy, knowing that you would ultimately want a national discussion to be incorporating views from any industry or any region.
Nate Kaufman runs the Omaha branch of the Kansas City Federal Reserve.
Making sure that I'm including views from Nebraska as part of it out of the Omaha branch, but then because of my background and the other area of responsibility is representing agriculture. So making sure that we understand developments in agriculture and rural parts of the country, because those may not always be represented if you're thinking about ultimately what drives employment and economic activity at a national level. Of course, you're going to think about large urban centers and industries that have an outsized role. But of course, ag would be part of what needs to be included in that. So my role would be to ensure that through ongoing research and industry connections and other things that we are maintaining a pulse on agriculture in rural America. And it could go in either direction, right? You would want to know how those potential changes would pass through in terms of Nebraska's economy or agriculture. But likewise, you could imagine that there's some scenarios of some anecdotes or things that bubble up from a particular region of the country or an industry that actually inform some things that you would want to understand about bigger pictures that might be a discussion in the context of monetary policy. So it could potentially work in either direction. But ultimately, you would want, I think, a central bank that is responsible for making a decision that affects everybody in this country and all industries. You would want to know that those decisions are inclusive of the totality of ultimately what this economy represents.
When talking about data, though, sometimes moving from traditional data to non-traditional.
Yeah, I'll give an anecdote on that one because it was actually pretty interesting and I learned a lot during it. But to answer the question at a high level, I would say it's a combination of two things in terms of trying to provide information. One is we rely on data. And of course, we have economists and analysts that are collecting that data and trying to learn lessons from what that data says. So are there trends that are emerging in the data? Is there a new data point that seems to suggest something different is happening? Of course, we rely extensively on data and those that collect them.
And sometimes it simply comes from talking one-on-one with people you meet on the street. But data can have challenges.
The challenge, or one challenge, with data is that it might often be too old to really provide useful insights into policy discussions that need to be forward-looking. So perfect example is right now, we had some announcements of tariffs a week ago, but if we are looking at data that represents January and February of this year and trying to learn lessons about what that might mean for trade, it'd be really hard to make that connection. Yeah. So data can often be backward-looking. The complement to that is we interact a lot with, we would say, industry participants in an effort to learn how they're making decisions and what they're doing. So we would ask regular questions in meetings, roundtables, board meetings, and other things along the lines of, are you hiring? Why or why not? What sorts of factors are affecting those decisions? How are you thinking about changing wages? What sorts of investments are you making and why? How are the market fluctuations affecting the decisions you're making? Because ultimately, the decisions that they're making, if you think about that in a collective sense, eventually will show up in data. It might not be a perfect match, but we're at least going to learn some lessons based on what those conversations look like.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Is it time to pull bulls?
Dr. Mark Johnson is Oklahoma State Beef Breeding Specialist.
We all have probably heard sometime in life in cattle production, the old rule of thumb about subtract 3 months and add 7 days, meaning if we pulled our bulls on July 14th, 2025, we would expect our last calf to potentially be born about April 21st of 2026. And that's a handy rule of thumb to keep in mind. When we consider whether or not it's time to pull bulls, we know that short breeding seasons equate to short calving seasons. Short calving seasons result in a more uniform calf crop that's more valuable when we market it. There's a lot of upside with regard to bull management of pulling bulls early, particularly on young bulls, as we think about maybe being able to go into a dry lot situation, providing a little bit of supplemental feed, recharging their batteries, so to speak, so that they're primed and ready for that next breeding season. But we've also got to consider some other things relative to the practicality of just trying to shorten that breeding season. One of them is, when was our last calf born this spring? If we have got cows that calved within 60 to 75 days, we know that even cows in good shape, good health status, are going to take about 60 to 75 days to be ready to breed back and maybe have that first fertile postpartum heat. Another consideration is just how long have we actually had bulls out? If we've had bulls out for 40 days plus and we're seeing a lot of return heats on the cow herd, it may be time to address some other things or give consideration to maybe rechecking that bull, having him undergo a BSE, maybe checking on the cows or considering what our nutritional plan has been for that cow herd for the past year, how thin they actually were at the beginning of calving season this year, maybe an indicator we've got some other problems there. We also have to give consideration to what is our plan for open cows. We know that the sooner we pull bulls out, leads to more timely preg checks on the cow herd, but what our plan is for those open cows actually matters. We ask ourselves another question. Do we have a fall calving part of our operation that we may roll those open cows into? If we identify those open cows now and intend to cull them, we know that we get the upside of a higher market right now as opposed to what those cull cows will be worth later in the fall. And while we want short breeding seasons and there's a lot of upside, the reality is that a bred cow in the current market we're in has more value than a cull cow, and we'd like to keep as many cows bred and in production as possible to capitalize on this current market.
We go from short breeding seasons, though, to Becoming a Leader. Justin Wagner is a Kansas State beef specialist.
I feel like leadership is always a journey, right? And just like you never stop learning, you never stop growing. And I think those people that are the best leaders, they're always looking introspectively in themselves and just finding new things that are out there, like Simon Sinek videos, right? That we're going to, you know, talk about and write some articles about, because, you know, we always have to grow in that journey that we're on. You know, for myself, leadership is instilled in some ways very early on. I think we maybe underscore that in our youth programs. You know, 4-H is a great way of building leadership skills and some of the things that we've talked about here. I myself was an Eagle Scout, as well as actively involved in 4-H. So I think those things we can instill early in young people as they go on in their roles. And we oftentimes don't place a lot of value in some of those, but I think it really speaks to the value of some of those early experiences. But I think the biggest part of the leadership journey is just a continuation to learn and put themselves in new environments and new challenges. And you have to have those new experiences. How do you have those difficult conversations with people? So continuing to grow and learn, I think, is a big aspect of leadership, is what I would say.
Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Now, look, for anyone that's paying attention, you know I'm trying to bring Medicare Advantage back where the incentives actually are about helping populations be healthier and not about risk scoring them, that it's a concentration of illness, but the incentives that if populations are healthier, plans can make more money.
He's the chairman of the Congressional Joint Economic Committee and a representative from Arizona, David Schweikert.
Inside here is also a great data point, Mr. Speaker. This year, we're going to spend, let's call it $1 trillion on Medicare. How many of you would guess what we're going to spend in 7 years? The model in here says in 7 years, we go from $1 trillion a year on Medicare to $2 trillion. We double Medicare spending in 7 years. Now, part of that is demographics. You know, starting in functionally 30 years ago, we started having a lot fewer children. So today, if we took today and stepped back 20 years ago, we had about 35 million of our brothers and sisters who were 65 30 years ago. Today, we're approaching about 70 million of our brothers and sisters who are 65 and up. So more than double. Go back 20 years ago, the number of 18-year-olds we have is pretty much the same as the number of 18-year-olds we have today. And next year, the number of 18-year-olds goes down. And the year after that, it goes down. And the year after that, it goes down. Is that Republican or Democrat, or is it just demographics? It's a little hard to campaign on that. It's a little hard to attack the other side. But the fact of the matter is, if we all read our data, we don't have a choice. This is the Social Security Medicare Actuary Report. Another thing I know every member here has actually read. 7 years from now, Medicare Part A Trust Fund, which is about 38% of Medicare spending. The rest comes out of the general fund. And members' participation, I think, is about 15%, the fees they pay. But that 38%, that trust fund, is gone in 7 years, meaning hospitals, surgery centers, everyone else, 11% cut. But I know we're all going to talk and work about how we're going to revolutionize the cost of health care, except one of the classic problems around here, Mr. Speaker, is for some reason on the left, and many of us on the right, we talk about healthcare as a finance problem. It's the ACA was a finance bill. It's who had to pay, who got subsidized. Medicare for All is a finance bill. I would argue the Republican alternative from a few years ago was a finance bill. It had a little better actuarial curve, but it was a finance bill. Who got subsidized, who has to pay? I beg of our brothers and sisters around here, open up your brain. We live in a time of miracles. We're going to have some conversation about how do you change the view of healthcare. It's what we pay. Can we change the cost by doing it better, faster, cheaper with technology, our brothers and sisters being healthier? Because if we don't, we have problems like it's on this chart. Today, 16% of all tax receipts go just to interest. In nine years, 30% of all U.S. tax receipts go just to interest. And heaven forbid, if we had a one-point movement in interest rates, my math is 45% of all tax receipts would go to interest. So when you see people come behind these microphones, how many people are saying, hey, how do we convince the bond markets? The bond markets are basically on the edge of running this country now, because when you borrow $6 billion a day, next year I think we borrow 6.5, maybe $7 billion a day. In 9 years, we're over $10 billion a day. If we're six, that's what, $70,000, $72,000 a second.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
It's a function of a central bank that has the ability of creating money, but not necessarily hard currency, by way of credit. So basically crediting the account of financial institutions that engage with the economy in every way with the economy that allows there to be more flow of credit and money available.
Nate Kaufman runs the Omaha branch of the Kansas City Federal Reserve.
So it's just an additional way of stimulating the economy, ultimately driving down longer term interest rates. The traditional tool of the Fed is to affect short term interest rates. And the balance sheet and the approach that would have been taken both during quantitative easing of 2010 and onward, as well as the COVID environment, would have been to try to affect longer-term interest rates and stimulate additional activity through those actions.